Good morning. Pacific Island nations are changing in significant ways, not since the post-war years. And this time, researchers say it's not just about the impact of the environment. Asian Development Bank senior economist Christopher Edmonds details the areas of change in our second half hour. First, a surprising look at some research on persuasion. Contributing editor Neil Milner has that story. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. The task of preserving the world's priceless artifacts has taken on a new urgency in recent years, and MidPAC students are working with 3D scanning technology to keep memories alive. And it's all about keeping the body's energy centers in balance. And Arlene Fox is preparing a weekend workshop on Maui on the 7 chakras of the body.
That's the conversation for Wednesday, April 20th. Now the news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Wondering just what it takes to persuade people, yeah?
We've had a couple of conversations about that, but this one, maybe you'll find it surprising as we did. Now, up until now, most social science research has stressed how difficult it is to change a person's political and social beliefs. We've talked about this one on the show before, you know, people resisting scientific information on, say, climate change, or maybe refusing to listen to alternative views on anything political. But some surprising recent research takes on the role of face-to-face persuasion in reducing prejudice. It has a surprising beginning because of who did the research and what it finds. It also has a surprising ending because it shows not how much we actually know about reducing prejudice, but rather how little. Contributing editor Neil Milner is back in our studio with a long view look. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's just go back a little bit and remember when we talked about that quite surprising earlier study that claimed to show that having gay people sit down and having a short conversation with folks about being gay made those people feel less prejudiced toward people. What happened with that one?
Well, this is a three-part story. Let's call it the fake study, the real study, and the aha moment, which is a kind of cautionary tale. The fake study is the one you just mentioned. Two political scientists did this study where they fudged the data, particularly one of them. The study was an amazing study because it was different from almost every other piece of persuasion research, because it showed that if a gay person sat down and carried on a conversation with someone who was not gay, that gay person could change that person's mind. That was very different for two reasons. One, you changed a person's mind about a basic social value belief. And second, it was done by a person who was different from the person whose mind was changed. Altogether different, an outlier. And people got very optimistic about it. But it turns out it was a fake study. How hard is it to be optimistic if you can create the data?
You cheat.
So guess what? So the interesting thing is then the whistleblowers, the two guys who were particularly courageous, went out and found the study, showed that it was fake. And then they took a next step and said, let's see what happens if you do a kind of study about persuading people in an honest way.
And that's the surprising beginning.
That's the surprising beginning. And that's Joshua Kala and John Brookman, two political scientists. So they do this terrific random study of the effect of trying to change people's minds about transgender and about anti-discrimination laws dealing with transgender. And they find that if you do this study right, you really can have this effect.
Okay, so what does it mean to do the study right? Well, how did they do something that was a little different than the fake study?
Well, first of all, they didn't cheat. Right?
Obviously,
that's a good start. But what they did was, first of all, they did a random study. They did a control group, and they did another group where their people were going to come in. Okay, so you're dealing with that. That's a good thing. The second thing is it's a very well designed opportunity to see what kind of intervention it is. So they try two different people stepping in to be the convincer. One's a transgender, and the other are people who are not transgendered. They go in and they do a couple of things. They ask a person what, and these, remember, these are just, they come in off the street. So they ask a person, first of all, what is your attitude towards transgendered? And then they do a couple of things. One is they show this video, a very short video, because this whole thing takes 10 minutes. And then they ask them to imagine themselves being transgendered. And it turns out that when you do all of this careful analysis, that not only were they able to change people's minds, that is to make them more pro-transgendered than they were compared to the control group who didn't have any of this, but that their minds were changed for at least 3 months.
And that's the difference, too.
That's the difference, too. So you had to. So the study's well-designed. It's a random study. And they find something, again, that you should be optimistic about if you're trying to get rid of prejudice. And that is that it did change people's minds. So the honest study showed what the dishonest study showed, only this one is real. Okay.
What does that say about being able to, you know, we've heard all those expressions, you know, walk a mile in somebody's moccasins, imagine yourself in somebody else's shoes, you know, do unto others, all of that real old school stuff that a lot of us got kind of, you know, in kindergarten, first grade.
Well, this is one of the old school stuff that seems to be supported. We'll get to what old school stuff in a minute that doesn't seem to be supported. The old school stuff is walk a mile in your shoes. It has a kind of fancy social scientific name, but it's basically this manifestation of imagining yourself as transgendered and thinking about that and talking about it. And the fact that you have to focus on something else, have empathy with something else, even if it's imaginary, we know from other studies of certain kinds of persuasion that that works. So then we're at this third stage where Elizabeth Levy Pollack, a well-known psychologist, publishes in the same magazine, Science Magazine, as this good study and says this study is great. It does everything right and it has you should be optimistic. But she also goes ahead and reviews hundreds of studies about persuasion that have been done in the last 20 years, and she says basically they're pretty crappy because they don't attempt to see how much the persuasion caused changes in attitudes toward prejudice, and secondly, they don't look at long-term effects.
So this seems to suggest that we don't really have a body of research that can measure this effectively.
Yes, I think that's right. We don't have a body that can measure it effectively because the focus has always been on other things rather than long-term. Long-term studies are hard to do. They cost money and people lose interest. They move on to other kind of academic stuff. So that's where we stand now. The fact of the matter is that the new study by Kala and Brookman stands alone. And standing alone is a good thing and a bad thing. Standing alone means these guys have done a very good piece of research on a very important issue, which is how can you change people's minds who are prejudiced, okay? The bad thing, and it's not their fault, is that it stands alone, that we don't have other kinds of good research and maybe the kinds of things that we've assumed, for example, the backfire effect, that if you try to get a person to change their mind, it'll backfire. They'll just become even stronger. And that's some of the things we talked about in the past about climate change is there. So it's an interesting study in terms of what it says about prejudice, how little it says about prejudice, and kind of the way that social science works, which is it's a very complex kind of thing. And it's always about how little we know rather than how much.
But that also opens the door to find out whether this is, or how well this could be replicated, and if there will be other studies that will add to the body of knowledge that they've created, which seems to, as you say, stand alone, or whether it's really is an outlier.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, the issue now is not methodological. The issue is really financial and let's call it social. That is, you can replicate this kind of study, but whether there are people who are willing to carry on this kind of research over longer periods of time, and also whether they can get the money to do this research is an interesting thing. I mean, for those of you graduate students who are listening out there in the social sciences, this might make a real interesting dissertation, albeit in a limited way.
But, Neil, I mean, clearly there have been so many years where we've done so much research on prejudice, and clearly the money's been there for that.
Well, it has. That's right. But you're right. But first of all, it may be harder to get money now from certain kinds of foundations, the government foundations. But the other thing is, if it's a long-term study, remember, you're kicking up the ante. You've got to go back. If this were to be a more long-term study, they would go back in 6 months and 9 months and so on. You're right. It's interesting how much this is not a complicated thing to study in terms of, you know, mathematical models or anything like that. It requires a kind of commitment, and it also requires us taking seriously that conventional wisdom may be wrong.
I bet you hear from a lot of graduate students.
Well, I never heard from them for the 40 years I taught. Maybe it's about time.
Okay. We're going to leave it right there. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sure.
Political analyst Neil Milner is our contributing editor for our biweekly segment, The Long View.
And this is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14 and coming up using 3D scanning to preserve the past. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about an unusual creature that's native to Hawaii. It's notable in several ways, including its unusual life cycle. It begins in the ocean, just offshore, born from larvae that are hatched in freshwater streams and then washed into the sea. As the larvae mature, they make their way back the way they came, swimming upstream in search of cool, fresh waters. Once there, they grow to about 2 inches in length, situating themselves behind rocks to collect drifting plant and animal material. They catch their food in a kind of basket made from tiny filaments, sifting edible material from the water as it passes through their front legs. This morning, we're looking for their Hawaiian name, and we'll be back with it next half hour. If you know the answer, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Good morning. I'm Karen Mason from the Hawaii Potters Guild. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Our cultural memories are kept alive, often, in the relics we leave behind, and too often historical artifacts are all that remain of vanished cultures. Today, 3D printing has opened up a whole new avenue of historic preservation, and students at Mid-Pacific Institute are working with technology created by a global 3D scanning organization called SciArc, to scan and create a permanent record of some of the treasures of Hawaii. Brinker Ferguson is the digital production manager of SciArc. She's been working with Mid-Pacific students, and she's with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Let's sort of give an overview of the technology, Brinker, just to sort of set the stage. But basically, you can scan a statue or a monument and have a very accurate record of its dimensions, everything about it, yeah?
Yes. Yeah, so at SciArc, we use a variety of different technologies, but our main one is LIDAR, or laser scanning. And basically, what it does is it uses a pulsed beam of light to record mm-hmm. the X, Y, and Z coordinates of the surface of a building. And this information not only gives us X, Y, and Z, so depth information, but also can give us some color information or intensity. So it calculates how long it takes to hit a surface and then return back to to the scanner. And we can take thousands and thousands of points in just a second.
Some of that technology has been around for a while, the whole idea of focusing a lens and getting distance from that once the image is sharp on a camera, for example. You can tell something's 100 feet away. But what does the laser add? Information about color, you said intensity of the color.
Correct. So say, for example, you were scanning a building that had some black color. Depending on how long it would take the laser beam or the wavelength for the laser beam to return to the machine, mm-hmm. we can tell if it's a lighter material, darker material, if it's a material that absorbs more intensity. So it gives us a lot of information, but we also do photogrammetry, which is using a camera and overlapping images by about 60%, and that gives us X, Y, and Z information as well. So as you just mentioned, kind of the stereo camera.
So you have all three dimensions recorded, and recorded really in great detail, yeah?
Yes, and actually this information, it's terabytes of information. And we, once it's in the archive, we can call that information back and not only create blueprints for engineers, but also conservators can use this information for line drawings. And then we also use the data to help tell the stories of the site and educate the public.
And what does it take to gather that information?
So depending on the size of the site, generally it's about a week to capture. We go to a cultural heritage site. We do what's known as a scan plan. So we sort of determine how to set up the laser scanner so we get every angle and every surface of the building or structure. And then really it depends on the size of it, but then we just start to scan and pull all of that data together.
We have, you know, history is filled with stories of civilizations we know almost nothing about because we have very few or no relics of them. And recent history, sadly, has seen the destruction of historical artifacts around the world. That's part of what SIARC does, is to try to preserve that, work against that trend, yeah?
Yes, and we were founded in 2003. With the destruction of the Banyan Buddhas in Afghanistan. And since that time, we have really had the mission to digitally document and archive at-risk heritage sites. We've done over 200 sites on all seven continents, and a large part of our focus right now is in Syria and Iraq and the Middle East, really at-risk heritage sites because of human aggression.
Yeah, well, human aggression has become a real threat. Are there other threats to the preservation of artifacts as well, one of them just being nature, yeah?
Definitely, as well as natural disasters, environmental issues. So working in Hawaii here, you know, one of the main issues that we've been talking about with Mid-Pacific students is global warming and the raising of the sea levels.
What kind of work have Mid-Pacific students been doing using your technology here in Hawaii?
So Mid-Pacific Institute, we've had a collaboration with them for about 3 years, and they use 3D laser scanning as well as a suite of software to kind of visualize and archive this data. And they've really been able to be trained with SIARC staff and take this to a whole new level. So they've done lots of sites all over Hawaii. I had the opportunity to visit the class yesterday. The teacher's name is Heather, and it was wonderful to see all the students making sure their metadata was correct and archiving and registering their data.
So if you are going to do this with a site that hasn't been archived before, you want to be able to get, I'll call them, just oversimplify it by calling, you want to be able to take pictures of it from all angles, or you want to be able to observe it from all angles and record from all angles. Do you kind of plan that out as you, say, encircle a statue or something like that?
Exactly. So before we visit a site, we do what's known as a scan plan, and we meticulously scan out or plan out exactly how we're going to capture every surface of a structure or building. And we do that through terrestrial laser scanning. We also use unarmed vehicles, also known as droned, mm-hmm. To be able to get the tops of structures. And then we also use other technologies such as structured light or photogrammetry to capture details.
So you would have a drone sort of flyover of a site, of an object, and then as it's able to transmit information electronically to a laptop computer on the ground?
So all of the data is captured on an SD card. And then once the drone returns to us on site, we pop out that SD card or pop out that data, put it into our computer, and on site we register the information to make sure that we haven't missed any portions or missing any data sets.
This is sort of like Uber photography in a sense. I mean, photographers work around the limitations of two-dimensional images and being able to only see things from a single perspective. But this is kind of an extension of what cameras do, right?
Yes. So with cameras, it's certainly wonderful to have that documentation. And actually, the Banyan Buddhas were photographed before they were destroyed. Unfortunately, what cameras or photography doesn't do, unless you do the overlap with photogrammetry, which is a technique, really photographs are for identification. But with laser scanning or photogrammetry, with that X, Y, and Z information, you can actually pull up engineering-grade calculations to know exactly the depth, the size of any structure or building.
You could reproduce a lost structure under the worst case scenario. You could actually reproduce something that had been lost using this in great detail, almost down to the everything except the specific materials, I would think.
Yes, and actually an example of that is several years ago, we did a project in Uganda with the Kasubi tombs. And unfortunately, after we scanned them, they were hit by arsons. The government then called us up and asked for the data, and we said absolutely. And they've begun reconstructing the tombs with the original materials and using that data to basically reconstruct the original blueprints of the site.
Well, let's hope that's not too often necessary, but it's great to know that it exists.
Yes.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Brinker Ferguson is a digital production manager for a 3D global 3D scanning organization called SciArc. They're doing a presentation this evening at Mid-Pacific Institute at Wood Hall. It's open to the public, showing student work of scanning historical sites around Hawaii. And that's available to the public tonight at 6 o'clock.
Springsteen said it in a song.
The loss of manufacturing jobs, that plays into the anger that we see now. This is why the song The River is of such interest.
Michael Goldfarb's Sad Look Back, and Springsteen's River rolls on. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after the conversation.
There are statistics no parent wants to hear. 1 in 8 middle schoolers say they've attempted suicide. Almost a quarter of that age group says that it has thought about doing it. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth.
We're talking about the Youth of Leadership Council for Suicide Prevention, statewide survey that's done, biannually?
Right.
And when we've seen these statistics come back before, they haven't really been all that great either in putting us into a national picture that shows that suicide is alive and well, and thoughts about it, too, in Hawaii.
The concern here, I think, is that mostly the focus on teen suicide has been with older teens that are in high school. And for good reason. In 2013, for example, we were the 7th highest in terms of kids in that age group who've considered suicide. But what this new survey is underscoring is the need to focus on kids in middle school. We've kind of been overlooking them. There's a sense that one researcher told us that kids that are in elementary school and middle school, they're just too young to be dealing with things like suicide. They should be happier. In fact, the statistics are showing us that we need to really reach out and be more aggressive, pay attention to this group, because the suicide thoughts, the statistics you mentioned, are quite alarming.
The fact that every time we look at this youth risk behavior survey and it shows statistics that most parents would find alarming, the fact that we seem to counter it with what you've just said, you know, the kids should be happy, and why are they thinking about this, seems to suggest that we're not really addressing it as well as we should be.
Well, it turns out that really kids in middle school, and you know this as a mother of three boys, they're going through some enormous changes, hormonal changes, changes with their body. They're encountering their peers on social media, and we know how dangerous that could potentially be. Bullying becomes more prevalent during these years as well. It's not until high school that they start to mature more. So by recognizing that these kids are, and they are kids, they're going through it at this terrible time, means that we should start training people to be gatekeepers, not only teachers and parents, but also community members and the peers themselves, to be able to recognize when someone is anxious, when someone's feeling depressed or angry, and then reach out to them.
Because more likely a kid is going to go talk to another kid.
Right, exactly. And prevention, or rather intervention and then prevention, are key to taking care of this. By the way, we don't know exactly why certain groups are more prevalent to suicidal thoughts, but we can tell you that it seems more pronounced among Native Hawaiians, kids that are in rural and economically depressed areas, and also military children. But it is a very complicated thing. No one particular reason can be pinpointed.
Now, we should say that the full study hasn't been released. That won't happen until about June, but you got at least some of the preview, and we'll talk more fully about this once the entire study is out. But thanks very much, Chad.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair brings us a reality check every morning.
Good morning. It's 8:30, and you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Chris Vandercook. If you want to be in touch, call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. We're on Twitter at HII Conversation, or at BKOZHPR. And you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up, detailing economic changes in the Pacific Island nations, and later, looking at internal connections of body and mind after news from the BBC. Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And Bert's on the line. Bert, we're going into space, yeah?
Yeah, you know, there's never a dull day when we don't get to go into space.
I know.
And this time around, you know, we've actually covered Pan-STARRS before.
Uh-huh.
And Pan-STARRS stands for the Panoramic Survey Telescope and Rapid Response Systems. And what they do is they take these pretty extensive surveys of the night sky. And one of the things that we had reported on a while back was their discovery of a rogue planet that was kind of traveling, you know, without, like a corresponding solar system. So that's kind of interesting. But the thing that they've been spending a lot of time on is taking surveys of near-Earth objects. And the idea is to identify, you know, all the, not only space debris, but asteroids and things that potentially might come into the proximity of the Earth, and sort of catalog all of that.
Bert, is anything hurtling toward Earth that we need to know about?
Well, I can guarantee you that there are things hurtling toward Earth.
Okay.
But whether or not we need to know about it at this moment, it's probably a low probability. And I think what people are definitely interested in is that it's not a question of when, well, how or, you know, if. It's a question of when. And there's another organization. We'll talk a little bit about them with the Pan-STARRS guys. It's called the B612. We had 612. And they actually are looking at putting a system together that will destroy that asteroid if it were to become, you know, kind of in the crosshairs of the Earth. So, yeah, there's definitely interest in trying to make sure that, you know, we take account of all the things that are out there and try to prepare for what might happen.
Well, let's hope we at least last until 5 o'clock this evening.
That's true. And it may be, you know, at least till 6, right?
Exactly.
Get
there you go.
The show.
Get the whole show. Thanks a lot, Bert.
Thanks, Chris.
Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Tom's River describes how one mother realized it must be pollution that was killing dozens of New Jersey children.
Whenever Linda had to take Michael in for treatment, she would meet another family from Tom's River. She wondered, why are there so many kids getting treated for cancer from Tom's River?
I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason, Thursdays at 6:30 on Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, now accepting applications for summer school for boys and girls in preschool through grade 12, with classes in digital media, art, robotics, and more. Full course listings at sacredhearts.org.
Most of the time when we talk about changes in Pacific Island nations, it's the impact of climate change and conditions, including lack of medical care, that take our attention. Recently, a group of international researchers has instead been charting changes in Pacific economies. Asian Development Bank senior economist Christopher Edmonds is among those researchers. He's come to Honolulu from Manila this week to lead a findings conference at the East-West Center. He says that Hawaii's Pacific Island neighbors are changing at a pace not seen since the post-war period. Specifically, that would include changes in export, imports, finance and banking, development assistance, tourism, and labor. And Christopher Edmonds joins us now to talk a little more fully about some of these issues. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to speak about the research the Asian Development Bank has been working on.
As we talked about just a moment ago in the intro, that most of the time we hear Pacific Island nations and thoughts migrate to climate change and the impact to a lot of nations, and also the social impact to Hawaii. But there's a whole part of the conversation that you've now researched that seems to be left out. Why?
I think there's always a tendency to focus on the most immediate disaster, and undoubtedly that is also taking up a larger part of what the Asian Development Bank is working on in the Pacific region in terms of emergency assistance, post-disaster reconstruction, urban planning to try to avoid the worst damages. But we do have these longer-term shifts in the global economy. We have trade costs coming down. We have sort of the economic center of gravity of the global economy shifting to Asia, and between the U.S. And other North American countries and Asia, we find Pacific right in the middle of that.
We talk a lot about the pivot to the Pacific, and in looking at how that is developing economically, there could be a good story and maybe a not-so-good story here with what's been happening.
Correct. So I think a lot of the things the Hawaii economy and other economies are facing with, particularly the rise of the People's Republic of China's economy, with rising their demand for raw materials. So a lot of the recent growth in the Pacific has been driven by the resource exporters. On its face, that's a very good development because you have high growth. On the other hand, it actually demands more from the Pacific governments because all of a sudden they have more resources to command, but often capacity is a little lacking. And left to its own devices, that growth doesn't tend to be very inclusive. In other words, you have a lot of wealth flowing into a country, but it's flowing into a small number, and it's not really creating a lot of new jobs. So, you know, looking at the long-term demographic forecast for the country, we're quite concerned in terms of the number of jobs that are going to be needed in these Pacific Island countries. They are some of the countries that continue to have among the highest population growth. And where are those jobs going to come? And that's where we see opportunities in some of the areas you had just mentioned in terms of labor, trade, tourism.
That assumes that the United States stays greatly involved with this. But we know that, for example, the COFA, COFA will be ending, the compact will be ending sometime mm-hmm. soon, and not necessarily big guarantees that the United States will be deeply involved with how the Pacific Island nations are reshaping their economies.
Sure. I mean, across the Pacific, you have a big divide between the North Pacific countries, where U.S. and to a lesser extent Japan still tend to be the dominant economic partners in terms of trade. In the South Pacific, it's much more of a realm in which Australia and New Zealand are the dominant partners. Along with People's Republic of China and other East Asian economies, representing an important source of demand for exports, source of imports, source of tourists to visit the Pacific.
But also control.
Yeah. I mean, that hopefully the countries remain in the control of their governments, but we have a lot of very young governments without a lot of capacity. They're also very small, fragile states, so it's a very long-term enterprise to try to build up that government capacity for self-governance.
That sounds tenuous.
Governance is tenuous everywhere.
So in looking at some of the other findings that you are going to be sharing as you're here this week, how do you think that we ought to sort of re-envision what's happening in Pacific Island nations that might be more realistic than just focusing on some of the issues, big as they are, on climate change and the impact to Hawaii socially?
So, I mean, there are, to me, this is a region which traditionally hasn't been in a lot of the public attention, but there are emerging opportunities in the region, especially as trade costs decrease and we work towards improving connectivity. So one of the active areas of ADB's activity in the region is helping governments install undersea cables. And we see a lot of opportunities with improved internet access. And if any of your listeners have been to some of these countries, you realize how horrible the internet access is. And that can be a real game changer for some of these countries in terms of accessing global markets, and even creates opportunities for particular types of entrepreneurs that didn't exist. So instead of, you know, they've always been hamstrung by the national markets are so small. But if all of a sudden you can get so you can ship goods out, we actually see a lot of opportunity for niche markets to develop. And, you know, that's going to be where jobs come. So a lot of it has to relate to the agriculture and fisheries sector and some of the very things that the Hawaii economy works on developing in terms of their niche markets for the high-end Kona coffee, the Noni oil, all these things.
So that seems to suggest a natural pairing with what's happening in Hawaii.
In many
and
ways.
And greater alliances. That's okay.
Absolutely. Excuse me. No, I mean, coming from Hawaii, I see a lot of models here because Hawaii has faced a lot of these issues earlier, had the benefit of you know, strong links to a large national economy. So in many ways, it does represent a good model for the countries.
Are there particular organizations in Hawaii that are actively looking at those alliances with other Pacific Island nations?
So we're here partnering with the Pacific Island Development Program of East-West Center. UH also has a number of people working on Pacific Island issues. But frankly, I'm always a little surprised working on the Pacific from the other side of the ocean, how Pacific the Hawaii-based organizations don't tend to be as active in the region as I find some of my colleagues from Australia or New Zealand.
Which seems to suggest that there might be some opportunities, but also jockeying for power, going back to the issue of who will step in the absence of somebody else. Can you overlay some of maybe what you've been looking at with regard to the TPP? Because that's had a lot of concern for people in terms of labor, in terms of what's going to happen job-wise.
Sure. I mean, the TPP from the Pacific perspective, although the word Pacific's in there, there's not one Pacific member. And so they feel a little left out of the process. At the same time, because of their strong trade links to some of the key members, we see it having very large effects.
As we have to go in just a minute, if there's, you know, one thought that you'd like to leave people with in terms of how we regard Pacific Island nations economically, what do you think that they need to walk away knowing?
Well, I think the big message is that there's a lot more dynamism and diversity in across the Pacific Islands than we've thought of in the past. So we do see high growth in some of the countries, and it's raising new challenges. And we're in an era of change in the global economy. So I think it's important that the U.S. stay engaged in the region, and people need to think about it because, you know, if we stay engaged in the development of these countries, it'll really prevent problems later on.
I look forward to talking to you more when you're back in Hawaii. We can sit down and do a whole town square and engage a lot of people in that conversation.
Sounds excellent.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Christopher Edmonds is senior economist in the Asian Development Bank's Pacific Regional Department. His work outside the ADB includes teaching and research assignments with the University of Hawaii Manoa, the East-West Center, and the International Rice Research Institute. The half-day public presentation, Evolving Linkages of the Pacific Island Economies, happens tomorrow morning at the East-West Center. Details are on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Today's backyard quiz, we asked you about a native Hawaiian species that's hatched from eggs in freshwater streams. The young wash into the ocean, then make their way back upstream to live out their life cycles in streams and estuaries. They position themselves behind rocks near fast-moving currents, sifting their food from basket-like filaments on their front legs. They're an exceptionally hardy species of freshwater shrimp that's able to survive far from their custom habitat, occasionally finding their way into storm drains and even air conditioner ducts. They make good eating, too, and that may be their primary claim to fame. Their Hawaiian name is Opai Kalaole, one of three species of Hawaiian freshwater shrimp. It is 8:46, and that's today's quiz. If you have one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hele aui ke kawai, e ike no ka opai, aia ia halawala, mamolo ka ginani. Ka opai, ka opai, ma ke kawai, ka opai, ka opai.
Aloha, I'm Chief Warrant Officer Michael J. Smith from the Marine Forces Pacific Band. You're tuned to HBR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HIConversation.
When we feel out of sorts, we often feel as if something has slipped out of balance. And for meditation guide Arlene Fox, we can do a great deal to heal ourselves if we learn to think in terms of the seven main chakras of the body. She's conducting a workshop in chakras this weekend on Maui, and we talked with her from her studio.
Chakras are actually junction points that we all have in our bodies. They're energy centers between consciousness and physiology, literally between consciousness and our physical body. And the centers of energy, they govern the core emotional and physical functions of our essential being. We have seven chakras in our body, and they run up and down our spine. Each one has a location in the body. It has a color of the rainbow associated with it, and it has a little bit of meaning for our lives. So the first chakra is located at the base of our spine. That's your root chakra. The color associated with it is a vibrant strawberry red. The meaning is stability. Our root chakra roots us to the earth. It gives us a sense of confidence in knowing that all of our deepest needs and desires will be met. The second chakra is creativity. It's located in the pelvic region, and the color associated with it is like a ripe, vibrant orange. And that's your creativity center. The third chakra is your power chakra. It's located in your solar plexus. The color is a bright sunshine yellow. And this is your power center. It gives you the power to manifest your desires, gives you a strong digestion in your body. The fourth chakra is your heart. Your heart chakra is what helps you exude love, compassion, happiness, joy, laughter.
So, Arlene, as you said earlier, the chakras are junction points, but it sounds as if that different aspects of behavior and feeling have physical settings in the body. Is that the idea?
Yes.
And through meditation, you can nurture these feelings and emotions?
Yeah, more than just meditation. There's actually a lot of ways to help open up and balance each chakra. You can do it through physical movement, through different postures, yoga postures. You can do it through sound, through toning different sounds. You can do it literally by meditation, but like something like a sun salutation where you're moving your entire body, you're opening up all your energy centers. And you want to keep them open. You want to keep them balanced, because if any energy center is out of balance, that's where you start to get physical ailments and dis-ease in your body. And you can tell, simply if you're having digestive disturbances, sometimes it's that energy center that's blocked. So you want to do these exercises, these sound openings, to help open up that area. And literally help to remove disease. And you want to make sure that all the energy centers are balanced, because if there's one that's out of balance, I can even like give you examples like Michael Jackson. His creativity center was just amazing. He was a brilliant genius, but yet he wasn't very grounded and balanced. So because he had that severe out of balance in his chakras, he had a difficult time in life. Albert Einstein is another example. He was just so extremely open and intelligent, but, when you're not grounded and balanced and feeling that openness in all your chakras, your life becomes out of balance and disturbed, and it can cause mental illness. Vincent Van Gogh.
Yeah, not a very happy guy, was he? So, in a way, it sounds as if an overabundance of any one quality that you describe as linked to these chakras, junction points in the body, that there's such thing as too much of a good thing. Then,
exactly. That's why it's so important to not just focus on keeping one chakra open. Because you don't want to be a genius in one level. You don't want to have a completely open heart, but yet not a grounded foundation, or you're just going to be giving, 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 and you're never going to be grounded and balanced, and that can lead to actually depression.
Well, you wouldn't want to suppress your creativity, for example. You would just want to bolster your more practical side. Is that fair to say?
Fair to say that you want to keep all of your energy centers in balance.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you don't want to literally just focus on one. And, if you're doing that, then and your other ones are being neglected and out of balance, then no matter how open you are in one, you're not going to be happy and vibrant throughout your entire life, because your body is going to be out of balance.
So what are some of the techniques? You mentioned sound, meditation.
Yeah.
How do those techniques play out? How does sound, for instance, help restore balance?
Well, when we create sound, sound actually nourishes every single cell in your body. And when you bring your attention to a specific area in your body, where attention goes, energy flows. So if I say, Chris, bring your attention into the base of your spine. This is your root chakra. Visualize the color strawberry red, knowing that this is going to root you to the earth, keeping you grounded, building your self-confidence, knowing that no matter what's going on, your deepest desires will always be met.
That takes a lot of internal discipline, doesn't it?
It does, but once you do it and you practice it on a regular basis, it just flows. And before you know it, you're like, whoa, how come I just seem so much more balanced? And you're like, oh, because I'm literally balancing my chakras.
Arlene Fox will conduct a workshop to explore each of the seven main chakras in the body through movement, toning sound mantras, and meditation this Sunday at 5 p.m. at Lumeria Maui in Makaua'u. You can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Each week, From the Top shares the stories and performances of outstanding classically trained musicians ages 8 to 18. HPR is proud to once again bring this national show to our islands for recordings this winter. We want to showcase Hawaii-based talent like Tiffany Chung, who you're listening to here. Send the talented kids you know to hawaiipublicradio.org/events to learn more. From the Top makes all casting decisions.
K-pop stars are products of fantasy world.
On the next Radio Lab, we enter the multi-billion dollar image machine that is K-pop.
The girl next door, all cute and, you know, like the ideal girlfriend kind of idea.
It's a prison you decide to walk into.
Join us for the next Radio Lab.
Saturday morning at 10, following the Splendid Table.
Oh, I'm still reeling over that, a prison you decide to walk into.
I know. I have to think about that, or try not to think about it. You know, Beth Ann, in an election year, we deal a lot with what people's attitudes are, and we think about prejudices and attitudes that are fixed in people. And I think we've come to think of a lot of social attitudes as very difficult to change, and things about attitudes about race, you know, very deeply ingrained prejudices, but maybe not as much, huh?
Well, given just that one study that we talked about this morning that, as Neil Milner talked about, is so standalone in its research and the way it was done and the surprises. And if you missed that part of the show, you can find it a little later when we upload the show to the archive. But just the whole notion that maybe it's not exactly the way we thought it was, even though this body of research for years and years has said, you know, it's just so difficult to change people's opinions.
Yeah. It wouldn't be the first time that a long-standing body of research had been debunked by a little further research, would it?
In a different sort of way. Or maybe the fact that maybe people really are changing just a little bit to make it something that could happen only now.
That'd be nice.
Well, on that positive note, we'll say goodbye at least for today. But we'll be back with you tomorrow morning. And we'll be talking tourism issues, including the dollar strength and interest rates, with Ameriprise senior economist Russell Price.
And a cross-cultural collaboration for Hawaii Pacific University student musicians. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of the show, as we mentioned, if you want to have another run at that Neil Milner segment that was from earlier today or anything else, you can find it all on the Conversation page with links to information and guests. Just look under The Conversation under Talk Shows on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Chris Vandergrift.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of The Conversation.